From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Not so long ago, it felt revolutionary to have a phone knowing exactly where you were and how to get where you wanted to go. Now a smartphone can tell you where your friends are, text your girlfriend when you've left work, push coupons to you based on where you've been and what street you're approaching, figure out if you're someone who goes to national parks or likes to stay home. We've come a long way in the ancient art of mapping. This hour, On Point, the history and fast-moving new frontiers of mapping and the era where we map ourselves. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you love old maps? What about the mapping of you? Do you have your phone's location tracking switched to on? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later in the hour, we will hear from two companies on the front lines of mapping you. But first, joining me in the studio is Hiawatha Bray, technology reporter for the Boston Globe. His new book is You Are Here, From the Compass to GPS, the History and Future of How We Find Ourselves. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Hiawatha Bray, great to have you right here.
Great to be here.
This takes us from really ancient history right up to date and some distance into the future. It is startling. You tell a great story of how humankind figured out, began over millennia to understand how to tell where it was in the world, where we were going, just what a tall hill that was to climb. Maybe easy to forget it now in the era of push-button GPS, but for a long time, the physical mass of this world was a great puzzle and perplexing challenge to us.
Oh, absolutely. It is amazing. It's one of the greatest human efforts, actually, in all human history, because, of course, we're naturally inclined to go wandering around for a host of reasons, personal, economic, military, religious, et cetera, and from the very beginning, simply figuring out where you were relative to other places was this immense and, at times, seemingly insoluble challenge. It's really kind of amazing, though, how relatively early on some of the most important aspects of it were discovered in ways that just completely amaze you. I mean, we all know the story about the Greek scientist Eratosthenes, I believe his name was, who figured out the circumference of the Earth and got it right within a couple of hundred miles just by using some sticks and the sun, and he figured it out. Some of this stuff could be figured out with remarkably simple tools, like figuring out the planet's latitude, where you were north or south, turned out to be relatively easy, and people were able to do that for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. The human ambition to travel across expanses was great even before we had any kind of sophisticated mapping and navigation. You remind us about the Polynesian sailors who would go with maps made of seashells and bits of straw.
They could use seashells and bits of straw to simulate the rolling of the ocean, and they would actually navigate based on the way currents would make the waves move in particular parts of the Pacific Ocean. And they managed over a period of hundreds of years to spread out over all the islands of the Pacific, making voyages that often took them well out of sight of land. This idea that people could not sail far out of sight of land turns out not to be true. Some very adventurous people managed it.
In shallower waters, some of the technology goes back. It seems so, well, crude, I guess, though I'm sure they used it in sophisticated ways, sounding lines,
where
they would actually map by dropping a line, a knotted line with a kind of gooey...
Yeah, they'd have grease or something on the end of this weight, and it would pick up whatever was on the bottom, and they would use that to figure out, here's what the bottom looks like, here's how deep it is, here's what it's made of, and that would give them some idea of the kinds of problems they would have sailing through that part of a shallow coastline.
Or maybe even where they were after their memory set in of, well, this part of the sea is so deep and has this kind of sand or shells at the bottom of it, so we must be here or there.
Absolutely. Stuff like that. Absolutely. And, of course, you had things like we know of at least one case of the Vikings who would be sailing throughout the North Sea and places like that. They would be using birds to help them figure out whether they were near land. It's like the old story of Noah from the movie that's now causing so much controversy.
The compass, which we take for granted, really before about 1,000 years ago, not in our toolkit, and then a great advance.
Absolutely. Although even from fairly early on, based on people's ability to do celestial navigation, they quickly realized that what the compass was telling them was north wasn't necessarily exactly north, and they began to figure out that the magnetic compass wasn't exactly reliable. And of course, in years to come, that would become more and more of a problem, especially when you start using ships made out of metal, and then everything becomes increasingly difficult.
The systematic exploration of the world by Europeans once they got going
yeah.
in the 1600s. Mm-hmm. Here's where mapping and consistency and new tools really become important.
Absolutely.
Describe the forces that converge there.
Well, yeah, you have obviously the military and the economic issues involved here. You're trying to conquer large areas, and you're also trying to trade over large areas. So precisely what you have to do is figure out how to navigate long distances, both over land and over water. And so you see really serious efforts to solve that problem on both fronts. I mean, one of the real breakthroughs comes in France, where you have the Cassini family that basically invents the first way to really accurately map an entire country using a method called triangulation. And France becomes basically the first country in the world that actually has its entire territory really accurately mapped. There's a story that I think it was Louis XIV was looking at the map as it was developed, and he shouted, "You guys have taken away a third of my country here."
I pictured it as bigger than that.
Exactly, because it turned out that when you use this triangulation method, you didn't have to walk over every inch of a countryside in order to map it properly. And they were able to figure out much more accurately what France's size and shape actually was. And when people saw the French doing it and the Europeans saw that going on, they started applying the same technology more and more frequently to all the other surrounding countries. And little by little, Europe starts to be very accurately mapped. And of course, they're interested in doing the same sorts of stuff in other parts of the world, too. So you have these grand mapping expeditions over the next several hundred years. Probably the most remarkable that is often forgotten was this whole British campaign to map India, where they had these amazingly well-trained people who were actually native to India, who they brought in and they trained and they sent to the most incredibly remote places under conditions of unbelievable danger and had them systematically recording all this mapping information to build a great map of India. It was an amazing accomplishment.
But even into the 20th century, there were still expanses, you know, described as unknown or unknowable.
Oh, yeah. Well, not quite. 20th is my favorite. My favorite has always been Africa because, of course, I'm the descendant of African slaves. And, you know, you see the slave trade, millions of Africans exported from Africa to the New World. And you figure, well, the people who did this must know a lot about what's going on inside Africa.
Yeah.
They didn't know a thing. They pulled up to the coast, basically, and had people bring them their slaves.
There was stuff in there. Who knew what?
Absolutely. It's not till like the late 19th century that you really start to get the interior of Africa actually mapped. It's just people didn't know what was there. Even the people who lived there, of course, they knew what was in their immediate area, but they didn't know the great area all around them. And that's one of the things that starts happening late. And you're right, it continues further and further on. Huge parts of the world weren't even mapped until well into the 20th century, or were not mapped very precisely.
But that century, the 20th century, just turbocharged this whole realm of mapping. And it of course, is the flight path to where we are today. Describe the key breakthroughs in the 20th century that allowed us to think of the Earth, our planet, as a planet that we can essentially know every nook and cranny of.
Well, yeah, I think that the real turning points come as a result of two inventions that are invented at almost the same time. And that's the airplane, which is really going to raise one of the biggest problems in navigation. And then the technology that's going to go a long way towards solving that problem, which is radio. Because first you get the airplane and people suddenly realizing, oh my goodness, we're up in the air and the maps we've got are designed for being on the ground. We have no idea of what we're looking at when we're looking at it from 1,000 feet up. And all kinds of problems arise with that. Of course, the airplane's first really major, massive use is in World War I. And there are all kinds of problems involved in trying to navigate while people are shooting at you. Yeah. And that suddenly becomes a very real issue. And then even after the war, as a commercial enterprise, you suddenly realize, especially with the planes of this day, which were relatively slow, they might fly at 100, 150 miles an hour, you suddenly realize if we can't fly at night and if we can't fly in cloudy weather, we might as well park these things.
And use the train.
And use the train, because a train runs. I mean, this is what happened when the U.S. Post Office decides they want to move the mail. Mm-hmm. They find out that if the planes have to land at night, they might as well just use trains.
So mapping requirements once you're in the air become much more demanding and sophisticated. Radio gives part of the answer.
Radio gives part of the answer, of course, because radio waves travel in straight lines, and they can be used as guidance for telling airplanes which way to go. They can also be used, and this is another thing that happens during the First World War, they can also be used to locate enemy troop concentrations when they start broadcasting on the radio, because you start having developments like the Bellini-Tosi technology that was developed by a couple of Italian engineers who figured out how you could use a radio locator to actually triangulate and find out exactly where a transmitter was. Suddenly, when your enemy is starting to transmit on radio, you can figure out exactly where he is.
Radio is a kind of airborne intelligence, and of course, the great extension of that goes into space with Sputnik, and suddenly it's satellites to GPS.
Absolutely. And that's where you're right. We start in on that. But I do want to mention also that there was another track that occurs around, well, actually, this starts in the 40s and gets really going into the 50s, where you have the rise of a technology. A lot of it was developed at MIT called inertial navigation. Somebody said, what if we wanted to devise a way of navigating where we didn't have access to radio, where we couldn't rely on receiving, like if you're on a submarine under the water? Could it be possible to build basically a black box where you tell it where you are when you start, and then that box, no matter where you go, can detect the accelerations and the movements of your vehicle and use that to figure out where you are at any given moment? And it turns out that it could be done. Some of the best physicists in the world at the time said it couldn't be done, but it turned out it could be done, and that became inertial navigation, and that's what you use to guide, like, submarines under the ocean. Unfortunately, you also use it to guide nuclear-tipped ICBMs. So, yeah, inertial navigation is a mixed bag, but it's an amazing breakthrough.
Behind so much of the navigation, real or imagined, those missiles never flew in the Cold War style that people really feared. Nevertheless, there was a huge investment in that. Meanwhile, the satellite system grows and grows. All this builds the foundation for the turn that Hiawatha Bray describes in his new book, You Are Here. The turn from mapping the world to mapping ourselves. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the great story of maps and navigation from ancient Polynesian sailors to our era, when everyone and perhaps everything is increasingly mapped, located all the time. Hiawatha Bray is my guest, technology writer for the Boston Globe. His new book, wonderful book, is You Are Here, From the Compass to GPS, The History and Future of How We Find Ourselves. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. We're going to hear in a few minutes from a couple of interesting companies who are very interested in where you are, where others that you care about might be. Hiawatha Bray is with me in the studio, and two pieces that we really should touch on here to bring us right up into this era where we're the material being mapped, the sort of path that led to Google Maps, and also now the OpenStreetMap, kind of our involvement in the mapping of the world today.
Absolutely. I mean, it really goes back a ways. I'm fascinated by this whole story. The first of all, the whole idea of mapping the entire planet, relying on satellite photography, and how that begins during the Cold War, the amazing threat that America felt from a Russia. People forget that back then we had no idea what Russia was doing, and everybody was terrified of another Pearl Harbor. So this whole idea of satellite mapping grows out of this early desperate need to figure out what's going on there.
They were shooting down the spy planes.
They were shooting down spy planes. And the very day that Francis Gary Powers is convicted in a Russian court for flying over their country illegally, we got the first spy satellite pictures of Russia. And it was just like, it was like night and day.
And there's the base of Google Maps.
And, well, that's where it really begins, because that means that now you have a practical way of using space satellites to basically map the entire planet. And, of course, the early ones were very primitive. They were incredible. You dropped a film canister from outer space, and it fell back, and they caught it in midair. It was just like a Rube Goldberg. It was unbelievable. They wanted originally to use TV, but the television technology of the time just was too crude. But then, by the late 60s, early 70s, you get the invention of really practical digital photography. And so now you have spy satellites that basically take pictures, extremely high resolution, and beam them back to Earth. Now, by the 1980s, this technology is no longer just being limited to the U.S. government and other governments. And you start seeing commercial companies in places like France starting to launch their own satellites and saying, we'll sell you basically spy imagery. And now even the U.S. government buys these kinds of satellite imagery from companies like Digital Globe. The CIA buys a lot of their spy photos.
We've got it down from space. We've got got it from the Earth, from ground level, at the sort of Wi-Fi level of navigation.
Absolutely.
And this people mapping as they go.
Absolutely. Because, you know, you have Google building using these maps. They go out and they buy the satellite images and they use them to build their own commercial map. But over in Britain, there was a guy named Steve Coast who was looking at this, and he wanted to do something similar using mapping data from British sources. But in Britain, all that stuff was copyrighted and he couldn't get it. So he said, wait a minute, thanks to the existence of GPS, I can have people create their own maps. We can use little GPS receivers and walk through the world or cycle through the world or drive through the world and make maps. So he created a movement called OpenStreetMap. Little by little, they mapped all of Britain, and now they are systematically engaged in mapping the entire world using nothing but volunteers armed with GPS, or often little more than a notepad, because you can update the map just by walking down the street and writing names and then calling or going to the OpenStreetMap site and looking at their map and putting in information as you go.
So updating. What's here? What's
Absolutely.
Here? What's here?
There are tens of thousands of people all over the world doing it. Now, Google sees this. They think it's a great idea. They have a feature like that now. If you see something that's not on a Google map, you can actually log on and basically update the map of the world anytime you see something. I did that. I was in Congo last year, and there were places I found while I was walking through Kinshasa that I couldn't see on the map. And then I said, okay, I went back to my computer, and I said, you need to add this, you need to add this, and Google just put it there, and it's up there on Google Maps now.
So what's on the planet around us, filled out, line by line by line by line,
That's
right. in greater and greater detail?
By each individual person with a smartphone or a GPS receiver. We can all do it now.
And, of course, while we're doing that, we become part of the story. Hiawatha Bray is with us. His new book is You Are Here. We map the Earth, and the Earth kind of increasingly maps us. Let's go to our listeners. Brianna is calling from Oklahoma City. Brianna, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to share with you an idea that I had, and at the time I thought it was just mind-blowing, and now I'm starting to realize that it's just reality. I was driving down the street one day, and I happened to hear a commercial for a restaurant that I was driving by, and I said, huh, what a good deal. And I thought, this should be advertisement all the time. Advertisement should be linked to where I am. Now, wouldn't it be cool if the cell phone technology in my smartphone could allow me to hear the advertisements that are directly relevant to my life at that time? And I thought it was mind-blowing. The more I looked into it, though, the more I realized that, no, that's actually just the direction that we're headed in. I think it's amazing.
Brianna, you're a genius, but there are a lot of geniuses out there, right? There's so much going on this front. I'm glad you raised it, Brianna. I mean, this is where so much is headed.
Absolutely.
Take us into this realm, Hiawatha, about, you know, our cell phones beam out where we are and the world's beginning to talk back. Retail coupons,
absolutely.
The whole thing.
Absolutely. And that is becoming commonplace. There are a bunch of various retail companies. Subway comes immediately to mind, where if you are registered for this kind of service, they will basically ping you when you are near a Subway and tell you about interesting and valuable deals. There are a bunch of advertising companies that do that. I mean, almost all, if you have a smartphone and you have ad-based apps, you're doing it already, at least to some extent, because the ads that you see on those ad-based apps will be sent to you based in part on where you are. They won't send you an ad for something for a retail chain that doesn't exist in your neighborhood. They may very well send you an ad for something specifically happening in Boston or Oklahoma City or so forth. That's already going on.
Or even in the aisle of a supermarket. I mean, they're responding Bluetooth-wise to whoever's standing in front of them.
Well, that's starting to happen now. You're seeing things like Apple's new service called iBeacon, where you walk into an Apple store and it is basically talking to your phone and telling you about things that you can find inside the store. There are a bunch of retailers experimenting with this. There has been a bit of a backlash, though.
Mm-hmm.
There was one company, Nordstrom's, that was starting to experiment with using it, and they heard from, I think, Senator Al Franken and a bunch of other people said, wait a minute, you're tracking your customers as they walk through the store? And then they said, no, we're not going to do that after all. But it's an idea that really has a lot of appeal, and not just for retail purposes. For example, when you're inside an airport, you're inside a sports arena, it would be great to know exactly where you are. And increasingly, there are apps that let you do that. There's an app right now. If you walk into a Walgreens, you can get an app. Every single Walgreens in America is mapped. You punch up the app. It says, you're in the Walgreens in Braintree. Mm-hmm. And it will tell you here's which aisle has which item in it, and it'll just guide you right there.
So the store is kind of x-rayed and revealed to you.
Absolutely.
Meanwhile, you may be x-rayed and revealed to the store.
That's
whoever
right.
else is watching. Hiawatha Bray's new book is You Are Here. He's with me in the studio here in Boston. I want to bring San Francisco in here right now if we can. David Peterson joins us there. He's vice president of mobile advertising at YP. It's a search and advertising company. Builds profiles of users, could be you, based on where they've been to better advertise to them. David Peterson, thank you very much for joining us from California today.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's your company do, sir?
Yeah, so we do very much like what you and Hiawatha were talking about. We use location signals that we see coming off of mobile phones to tag users, to understand users' behavior based on their location. Because as you've talked about, a lot of times the places that you go, that you visit, say a lot about who you are as a person. And that's very interesting data. It's very interesting for sociology reasons, I'm sure, but it's also very interesting for mobile advertising. So it starts off with the fact that in the digital ecosystem, as I'm sure that you're aware, the digital media industry creates a lot of data when you surf the web, the places that you surf, the IP addresses, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And in mobile, sometimes that involves, although not always, the use of location data. So that's something coming off of your phone when you have opted into that via an app, for example, or a website that you surf. And so we're one of the parties that sees that information. And what we do with it is we look up every one of those data points. And we say, what does it say about you as a user? So if you look at my data, for example, you'll see a data point that says, when you look it up on a map, oh, you were in the parking lot of a Target south of San Francisco.
Okay.
And that allows us to tag me as a Target shopper. You'll also frequently see me in airports in the middle of the week, and thus I'm a business traveler. You'll also see me at campgrounds and national parks. And that really says a lot about who I am and the kinds of things I like to do.
So if you track me for, I don't know, 6 weeks, 6 months, you know where I am all the time, and you know what's at those places where I am, how much can you tell about me, David?
Yeah, so the way that we think about it is, as we see those location data points, what we're doing is going, looking up each one of them and building a tag, in that we don't really think that it's useful to track users over time and to find all the places that they go and memorize that. What we're much more interested in is what are the kinds of things that we learn about a user, about the places that they go. And so what we're interested in doing is just coming up with a set of tags associated with each user that just tells us things about you as a person that might be useful for advertising purposes.
So you don't call that tracking, but you are building a profile of me based on the content of the places I've been?
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's you can think about it as a collection of tags. And so if you look at me, I'm Target shopper, business traveler, you know, very infrequent fast food restaurant eater, national park goer, et cetera. That's right.
And you sell that then to companies who will do what with it or who are doing what with it?
Yeah, so we don't actually sell the data. What's interesting is and what's important to know is that we have advertisers come to us who are interested in talking to users who do various things. It's very interesting to advertisers to be able to talk to people who shop in different kinds of retail stores, for example, or quick serve restaurants or other kinds of what we call vertical categories. And so what we do is we build and run advertising campaigns for those advertisers. We run directly and serve advertisements in mobile apps and on mobile websites based on this information that we have. And so this is where if you use apps or you use the mobile web, what you see is a lot of advertising in that medium. It's an ad-supported medium. A lot of this stuff is free for you, the consumer. And so the way that gets paid for is it's ad-supported. It's similar to what you see online or even the newspaper.
Is it by name? Do they know it's me, Tom Ashbrook, that they'd be advertising to? Or in your world, am I just a number?
That is a great question. You're just a number. You are XYZ123. We don't know who you are at all.
And yet, you may know a lot about what that number, me, will do. David Peterson, standby in San Francisco. Hiawatha, here we are.
Yeah.
I mean, this is mapping, which includes location mapping, and I have read that. Mm-hmm. Follow somebody for, I don't know, 3 months, and you can predict with a very high degree of accuracy what they'll do next at any given moment.
Which, if you think about it, isn't that shocking. Most of us are highly predictable creatures. I don't think you'd even need 3 months. I mean, if you know somebody reasonably well.
Here's where he goes to work, or here's where she goes to work, or shop, or you name
sure,
it.
Or work, shop, church, whatever. And it's not that hard to figure out. That's exactly right. And of course, I think companies like, it's YP now, used to be known as Sense Networks. Mm-hmm. Companies like this are indeed trying to be careful about not revealing information about individuals, but it does give them the ability to profile basically populations that they can sell to advertisers. Personally, I don't find this kind of thing particularly disturbing. I think it's kind of interesting and even cool.
Brings all kinds of convenience to people, mm-hmm. but it also over time has some really interesting implications. We're looking at maps, navigation, and the era today where we are the mapped. Where do you see this going, Hiawatha? I mean, are we headed toward that Minority Report vision where the world's constantly talking to us because it sort of recognizes us by profile, if not by name?
I don't know, but I'm worried a little bit about it, especially because, I mean, a company like YP isn't using it this way. But you know that there is considerable interest in this whole idea of predictive computing, where you could actually predict what a human being is going to do based on this information, not just the location data, but all the other information that is being collected about people. I mean, this is a small example, but it always makes me vaguely nervous. There are already several states that use a computer program to decide whether or not to give convicts parole. And one of the things they do is they look at the past history of this person and other people who have committed similar crimes, and they try to predict whether or not that person is likely to commit a crime. Now, I mean, it makes a certain amount of sense, but you sit there wondering, how far down that path do we really want to go? And I always get a little nervous about attempts to try to predict human behavior by where we are and what we do.
David Peterson in San Francisco, I suppose part of your job is to make us feel comfortable and good about all this, but I mean, we've all seen Minority Report. This predictive business is, in fact, I would think, part of the value proposition of your business. I mean, how sophisticated do you think this will be able to become?
Well, honestly, I think that's a little far-fetched. I mean, I think that what we see happening in the advertising industry is that all of this information is collected, for example, under opt-in. And then we also give you multiple opportunities to opt out. Like, this is all based on, and I think we strongly support the idea of consumer choice in all of this. So I think that I personally haven't seen Minority Report, but it sounds rather...
it's probably seen you.
Right. And so what I would say is that what we're big proponents of at YP is giving the consumer choice and respecting consumer privacy. And I think you're going to see more of that. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that starts with the fact that what we see in the mobile advertising ecosystem is that all of this is collected under what we call, it's called opt-in. It's that users have said, okay, I'm giving you permission to use this data. But, you know, furthermore, we like to offer multiple opportunities to opt out as well. So for somebody to say, you know, this is something that I'm really not comfortable with. And so I think that's, I would probably contrast that pretty strongly with the idea that we're all being tracked all the time and it's completely out of our control, because it isn't.
Hiawatha, unlike the planet, we have will.
Yep.
And people opt in very willingly a lot.
Absolutely.
Because of the convenience.
Oh, no. What he's saying is absolutely true. You can opt out of this stuff. You can turn off the location tracking, but it is...
To a point.
Well, you're right. Let's understand this. First of all, the moment you have a cell phone, you're being tracked by definition. It's the nature of the technology.
By the nearest cell tower.
Exactly. They have to know where you are. So the only way to completely eliminate it is to have no cell phone at all.
Mm-hmm.
But with all of these apps and other things, yeah, you can turn them off completely. Nobody is then being able to track you. I mean, a lot of people don't know this. You can download GPS software for your phone that does not talk to the phone company or to Apple or to Google and is a purely standalone product. So you can do navigation.
But as a rule, we don't opt
as
out
a rule,
in this
we don't.
Way. The
That's
social
right.
pressure is there. The convenience pressure is there.
Absolutely.
And we make each of ourselves dots on a map.
Absolutely, because it's almost irresistible. It is so useful that people find it almost irresistible. I know I find it irresistible. I can't imagine not going with my location system.
David Peterson, how much more convenience or sort of tailored marketing do you expect will come at us over the years with technology business like yours?
Well, in general, as an industry forecast, I'd say more rather than less. And so I'd like to start that by saying I don't think you're going to see more ads. I think that we already see a reasonable number of ads or the right number of ads that supports the industry medium. I think this is what we're really talking about is the difference between seeing ads that are useful or interesting to you and ones that are not, right? So I think what all of these technologies are doing is saying, okay, as you are cruising the web or you're surfing apps, and these apps build all their content and they hire people to do it and they need some sort of financial revenue source to support that. The way that they do it is frequently through advertising. It's something that users love, right? You don't have to pay for things, and then it's ad supported. But it really helps the equation if you can start to deliver things, ads that people are really interested in.
Irresistibly convenient. Use the app. You're on the map. YP does it. David Peterson is vice president there for mobile advertising in San Francisco. David Peterson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great story of maps and navigation from ancient Polynesian sailors to our era when everyone and everything is increasingly mapped, located all the time. Hiawatha Bray is with us. His new book is You Are Here, From the Compass to GPS, the History and Future of How We Find Ourselves. Things are changing. Here's 1939, Wizard of Oz. Dorothy, Judy Garland, has to figure out for herself where she's landed after getting caught in a tornado.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. We must be over the rainbow.
Yeah, the world of mapping has changed. The company Hero offers a watch with a GPS device so parents can always know exactly where their kids are. Hear from their video.
Current GPS products are not designed with young kids and parents in mind. So we involved kids from day one to develop the smallest, coolest GPS tracking device designed specifically for kids.
It's the big turn that Hiawatha Bray makes in his book, You Are Here, from mapping the world to humans being mapped. And the need, maybe now, for each of us to think about a cocoon of locational privacy. I mean, companies do it.
Yep.
Governments do it. We've learned in the last year. The United States government does it through the NSA. Edward Snowden has laid out clearly for us. Describe the extent to which we are now the material of maps, mapping.
Well, pretty much universally, at least based on what we are getting from some of the Snowden revelations. I always try to take it with a grain of salt because we cannot be absolutely sure that everything Edward Snowden is saying is gospel truth. But a lot of it seems to be, there seems to be enough evidence to support the idea that a great deal of it is true. And, you know, there are reports to the effect that the U.S. government is at least not necessarily domestically, but outside of the United States, snapping up location data on hundreds of millions of cell phones as a matter of course. And that, of course, would include Americans traveling abroad. The Washington Post recently reported that. And it's just startling to think that they could have that kind of information. But just to give you another example, which I found really startling, one of my colleagues at The Globe wrote a piece recently about how private companies are using this technology called license plate cameras to basically take pictures of millions of license plates on millions of American automobiles and store that information away. Now, if you do that over a period of months or years, you basically know where everyone in America is driving and can look it up whenever you want it if you have enough cameras in enough places. Now, we already knew that police agencies were doing this, but now we find out that private corporations do it. And the danger here, and we see this with the examples of what the NSA does with companies like Google and Microsoft, you know that a private company has this data, and you might not even mind if a private company has this data, because private companies don't run maximum security prisons. But now the government goes to these agencies and says, give us what you've been collecting on these people. And suddenly, all this information that you thought was just being used to advertise to you is now being used to engage in criminal or national security investigations. And there's really not a lot of limit right now on what kinds of stuff the government can collect.
Researchers have found, you write, that just track our cell phone's usage patterns over a three-month period. You can predict where a person will be with 93% accuracy after 3 months. And now you're talking about keeping track, mapping us over time. You can reach back in time to see where have they been. Imagine where we may go. Of course, a lot of people opting into this. I mean,
sure.
Foursquare and all these apps where people are saying, they're punching in themselves. Here I am. Here's where I am now. Here's where I am now. Here's where I am now. So their friends will know they're in community while they're in motion.
Oh, absolutely. The appeal of knowing where you are and letting other people know you are is immense. I mean, that's one of the reasons this is happening. Most of us are not hermits. We don't mind some people knowing where we are. And that's why we always or almost always opt in. And this seems like a perfectly sensible thing to do until you suddenly realize, like there was one survey that was done that found that half the apps on the typical smartphone are recording your location. So, and not just you, Angry Birds. When you run Angry Birds on your phone, the company that makes Angry Birds is getting a report on where you are.
And when you stop playing Angry Birds?
Actually, according to a study that was done by MIT back in 2012, I don't know if they've changed it since then, but they found that the Angry Birds app kept on telling them where you are even when you stop playing the game. It was like, what? Wait a minute. Because it's mainly for advertising purposes, but a huge percentage of the apps we run are tracking us. So each company that makes that app, they know where you are, and they know where you are, and they know where you are. dozens, hundreds potentially of businesses, all knowing where you are.
We mapped the earth, and now we map ourselves. Mm-hmm. Hiawatha Bray is with me in the studio. Richard is calling from Mystic, Connecticut. Richard, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi. Fascinating. We kind of morphed from the idea of the technology of mapping into our privacy concerns. And I wanted to bring back to an issue with regard to use of the technology for navigation.
Yes.
And how it becomes we put blinders on when we do that. Mm-hmm. But first, I want to point out, in terms of the privacy, all you got to do is read Fahrenheit 451 or 1984. We're there. We're in the 1954 prediction that Bradbury had in terms of the ability for television walls that can tell where we are, things that go in our ears that they described in Fahrenheit 451. So, but enough said on that. Let's get back to the technology. I'm a boater. I'm from Mystic, home of the Charles W. Morgan that's going to be relaunched this spring. And I am very sad to see how much my fellow boaters are relying only on GPS and the technology. An example was coming years ago through, about 4 years ago, through the fog in a 100-year-old boat with a good friend of mine who wanted to stop because there was fog, but he had GPS. Well, it's kind of a long story. Our biggest concern was other boaters going through Buzzards Bay at great rates of speed because they could rely on this technology without regard to whether they might run somebody else down.
Oblivious to what's actually around them, but confident in their oblivion that they were headed toward their goal.
Oh, that's a great story.
We had a kind of a contest, if I can just finish this up.
Yeah.
He did GPS navigation. I did map navigation, what I call seat of the pants. I wasn't using dividers. I wasn't using parallel rules. I was just using my arm to get a rough idea.
Yeah.
I was almost as accurate as he was. But when we got into Sakonnet River, his GPS, he had three on board. All three of them failed.
Wow.
I had to take over the navigation. So we lose those skills. Coast Guard is no longer teaching celestial navigation. It's a thing where it's very sad to see that we are becoming, again, very myopic. If our GPS goes down, we don't know where the heck we are.
Yeah.
And we need to make sure that we recognize this technology has to be used wisely.
Richard, I'm so glad you raised that. Let me take it to Hiawatha Bray. Yes, we've been super empowered by all the advances that you describe, Hiawatha.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, you never know when the satellite goes out, when the system goes down, and how rapidly do we become directionally challenged just from lack of practice?
Well, no, I think you've got a fair point, but I don't think that kind of thing is a problem that most of us are going to run into. I don't know that many of us are boaters, but he's making a great point, I would think, for anybody who does do that kind of thing, or for people who fly airplanes, for example. I do not know what the current state of training is, but I would assume that they still have to teach these guys basic standard navigational tools, because if they don't know how, you're exactly right. It's not so much that the satellite system is going to go out. That's very unlikely to happen. But whatever device you happen to be using, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you could have run into all kinds of problems, but you always have to take into account the human factor. My favorite example is the KAL-007 aircraft that was shot down over Russia when it strayed into Russian airspace back in 1983. As far as we know, there was nothing wrong with any of the navigational gear on that plane, and the people knew how to use it, but somebody apparently turned a knob to the wrong setting, and it was as simple as that. The plane did not follow the waypoints. Instead, it flew right into Russia, and nobody even bothered to check.
I mean, I'm just so struck. Here's Richard doing Seat of the Pants in the fog. You know, I'm struck at these days, you get in the car, turn that you're following the GPS instructions, and you can kind of feel that the human mind can turn off the directional awareness and just turn here, turn there, turn here, turn there. Whereas back in the day, many people at all moments had a kind of sense of where they were. That spatial awareness can diminish.
Well, you certainly, I mean, I'm sure everyone who's used GPS has had a moment where that thing tells it something and you go, that's wrong. I know that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And you go a different direction and you're right.
Sure.
That always does happen. These things are not perfect and you have to use common sense. That's always going to be true. I agree with that 100%.
Chad in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Chad, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, what is the deal with the Wi-Fi networking pertaining mainly to iPhones right now, but it's something that they kind of slipped into the new iOS update. And what I hear it's about is that instead of having a router in your house, your cell phone is going to be the router. And I switch it off because it's kind of a battery saver, but it's in the privacy settings and location services and system services.
I'm not sure that has anything to do with this, but I think you're talking about that feature that allows the iPhones on iOS 7 to talk to each other directly. And there is a feature like that, but I don't think it really has much to do with navigation.
Well, but Chad, thanks for calling. You do describe Wi-Fi being roped into the world of navigation.
Oh, absolutely. And that's another thing. That's a Boston idea. These guys in Boston who started a company called Skyhook, and they were trying to come up with some other business model for a Wi-Fi. And in the process, they drove around and mapped the location of a bunch of Wi-Fi routers, and then it suddenly hit them. Wait a minute. Couldn't we receive the signals from those Wi-Fi routers and connect them to latitude and longitude so that as you drove down the road, the Wi-Fi that you encountered on the street would tell you where you are? And it turned out it worked. It worked. It's not as accurate as GPS, but it's amazingly close. It'll get you to within about 100 feet. And now that is standard equipment on just about all smartphones.
Hiawatha, stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation from Haifa, Israel, Udi Dagan. He's founder of a company called Split. It is known as the anti-social app. All kinds of social location apps, Foursquare saying, I'm here, where are you? Udi Dagan, yours does the opposite. What's the point of Split?
Well, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great to be here. Well, the app Split, or Split Anti-Social, as it's in the App Store, was designed perfectly to help us avoid unwanted encounters. Or in other words, we all have people we prefer not to meet. We just kind of turn everything upside down and create a system that helps you just avoid these encounters.
So you're using data from Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Foursquare that's got geolocation on it. And what, if you don't want to meet your ex-girlfriend or boyfriend or wife or husband, this will alert you where they are when they come into your realm.
Yeah, not only alert you, it will also offer an escape route just to keep you safe, you know. But I mean, the discussion before was really, really intriguing, and it's really important to connect this because, yeah, we basically take all our data from social networks, from Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Foursquare, but we also use GPS location as our own network. As regard to privacy, which is really, really something we care about, as location is really sensitive, we only provide, you know, we kind of make a network which also only expose your location when you need to. And in our case, it's only when you're really close to your ex, for example. Then the app will expose your location.
Watch out, turn left. Because we can easily see how Split could turn into stalk if you're trying to keep track of other people. Udi, what keeps it from becoming a stalking app? I mean, I may want to avoid somebody, but if they're on my list, why am I not just figuring out where they are and stalking them?
Yeah, well, it's very simple. I mean, in Split, the user has control over his exposure, his or her exposure, and it's the amount you can be very exposed, or you can choose not to be.
Yeah, how do you do that? Let's say my ex doesn't want to be tracked by me, but I want to track her. Aren't you on my side in this?
Yeah, well, for instance, if I chose to avoid you, I can tell where you are. I cannot tell where you are unless you are logged on to Split.
Oh.
Or you provided social location, social input, social network input.
Oh, but everybody's providing social network network input these days.
Yeah, but you also have to be very close to me, very close to my surroundings.
Okay.
I mean, I cannot see on the map everyone. It doesn't show. But if I chose to avoid you, you have to be logged on to Split or otherwise provide a social input which everybody can see in your social network account. Otherwise, I cannot see you.
It's amazing. Hiawatha, here we are, not only using GPS to know where everybody is, but now turning it around, not things you want to find, but things you actually want to avoid. Talk about an evolution of mapping
absolutely.
And navigation.
I've never heard of anything quite like it. It's an interesting approach, definitely. Most of the time, though, we're mainly, you know, either trying to find or be found. And this is, well, it's different.
Udi, are people signing up? Help me avoid X, Y, or Z, my boss, I don't know what.
I guess both of you want some time, you know, have a pint on the way home without anyone bothering you. It's basically about regaining control over our life. I mean, there's a thin line these days between the real world and the virtual world. And while we keep the privacy and everything is kept really seriously, we provide like the perfect antisocial experience. And you know, it's really fun and it's also shown the map places where your avoidees tend to frequent based on, again, only on available data.
It's cool.
And it's like, yeah,
it's really amazing. Udi Dagan, we're nearly out of time here. Founder of Split, joining us from Haifa, Israel today. Udi, good luck to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Did he coin a new term, avoidees?
I think so.
I think so. Like that.
You write about the next challenge. It seems like the opposite of mapping, but forming a cocoon of locational privacy around ourselves.
Yeah, I'm not sure we know entirely how to do it yet. There are people like, I mentioned a guy,
IBM.
Yeah, at IBM, mm-hmm. who is working on trying to
find ways.
Jeff Jonas. Mm-hmm. Jeff Jonas at IBM, who is working on technologies that would allow you to use your location devices without giving away your location to other
people. Is this cloaking? Is that what that
is? It's a sort of a cloaking system. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some aspects of this which could have been done if anyone had thought of them ahead of time. Classic example being the EasyPass tollway system mm-hmm. that gives away our location when we drive down a toll road. Mm-hmm. They could have designed it so that you didn't get your name associated with the EasyPass, but they didn't. And so when you use an EasyPass, they know who it is, or at least who bought that particular pass. And what they're saying is, in future, when we develop technologies like this, let's see if we can find some way to separate identity from location so that we can keep some of our privacy.
Do you think that's going to happen? I mean, you may think it's a good idea. Yeah. I might too. A lot of listeners may. But surely there's a lot of commercial interest and, face it, surveillance, law enforcement interest in knowing where are you and who are you.
It's going to be a tough one because, for example, if you tried to do that now with EasyPass, every police agency in the country would
say, no way,
we want to know your name. So, yeah, it's going to be a real challenge to get that to happen.
Hiawatha Bray's wonderful new book is You Are Here, From the Compass to GPS, The History and Future of How We Find Ourselves. It's a great tour. We just sipped at it in this hour, but what a wonderful story. Hiawatha, thank you so much for writing it.
Oh, thank you.
Hiawatha Bray, great to see you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.